American consciousness since the inauguration. I think that's a good thing.
There've been letters back and forth in our own post dispatch and other places, as if the neighborhood was too small to accommodate more than one or two kinds of poets or poetry. And I would just like to say that for me, poetry has always been a matter of bringing real life to the language. And I think there is room in the neighborhood, as long as all poets would agree that their job, no matter how they go about it, is to bring their language to real life.
And I hope we can give you some of that.
I'd like to start with a poem that features a little bit of UFO lore, and I'll close with a poem that features a little bit of UFO lore, though neither poem is about UFOs, but growing up, flying saucers were my life. And this poem is called A Long Way from the Starling, and it begins with a piece of information. People here know about these UFO abductions, and people who are spirited away by little hominid beings and probed with instruments and aboard spacecrafts. Am I talking any sense here to anybody? This is, it seems to me, a manifestation. It seems to me a less interesting manifestation than some of the wilder flying saucer tales that I grew up with in the 50s, but we'll get back to that toward the end of things. This poem begins with a little quotation about what happens to these alleged UFO abductees as they are kidnapped by the beings and taken on board the craft. The only thing you really need to know is a common occurrence amongst many of these cases is that these people claim to remember little or nothing about the experiences until it is brought back to them under some version of hypnosis, and that the phenomenon on which they apparently on board the ship, usually a couple of hours, is known as missing time. And I just started playing with the notion, what a wonderful 1990s idea. If there are a little bit of time we've lost track of, this, friends, is the answer. The poem is called A Long Way from the Starlight and begins with a quote from a symposium, UFOs in the 90s, where the speaker suggests, under hypnosis, UFO abductees often are able to recall the unsettling events that occurred on board the craft during a period of what's usually no more than a few hours they cannot account for in their waking lives. This aspect of the phenomenon is known as missing time. Let me know if this microphone is a long way from the starlight. When it came to the starlight drive-in, everyone I knew was willing to go to extremes, hunkering down in the back seat, laying low, packed together in a dark of someone's trunk. We thought so little of using up our lives a couple of hours at a time in the washed-out glow of the starlight, where feature after cheesy feature reeled off its bargain basement share of the only intelligent life in the universe we wanted in on. Teenagers from space, invaders from Mars, captain of the moon. And like it or not, I remember them all without trying. Whatever I might have been thinking at the time, it turns out that most things aren't nearly forgettable enough. Not the obligatory scientist's earnest and beautiful daughter, falling one more time for the cub reporter who can't believe his luck. Not the sad, radiated creature growing to 50 times its natural size. Not any hapless alien a long way from home who means us no harm, not any who does. Not another histrionic question mark when we all finally make it to the end. Not the most inept attack of, or the dumbest brain that, not the smallest thing, that misguided piece of 1950s bad advice, watch the sky. As if some grade B human vigilance might somehow be enough to guarantee that whatever happened there that night surely would never happen again. And I wish I could be one of those people who never stopped watching, but remember only under hypnosis what they saw, taking themselves seriously back to that time they can't fathom any other way, to a place where everything strangely in focus for once, made up of amazing circumstances that never occur to them otherwise. Spaceships, examination tables, telepathy in the nude, vaguely biological experimentation. Now they're lying down again, counting backward from 10, and in their deepest artificial sleep, they can't stop dreaming up story after story they've been chosen to star in. They're covering that stretch of road again between where they were picked up and where they were inevitably let down. Between the car stalling out and the engine running again like a dream where nothing ever really came off. Between the swagger at midnight, the cold sweat at 2 a.m. These days, they pour their whole lives into filling the hole in a day they didn't even know was there. And I don't know where they find that kind of time. Something like that should be harder to forget, especially in a world so full of smaller, oddball wonders, it's impossible to stop recollecting. The light in the attic of a childhood that went out with no warning, freezing you in the sudden dark. Daydreaming through Debbie Fuller's brownie uniform while she carried on nobly with a bad day show and tell. How the school nurse smiled and swore this would be the last shot of anything you'd ever need. The capital of Wyoming, maps made out of soap, Avogadro's number, the Pythagorean theorem, every explorer who sailed the seas of third period history, no land where they served lunch in sight. And later, the name of every bar you learned to spend long nights in, trying to forget it all, remembering perfectly well the number of the cab someone always calls for you, how it gets you miraculously home. So is it asking too much of our abductees to know by heart that beam of blue immobilizing light that floated them on board? The silvery suits, the avocado heads of the alien crew, the lasers and precision instruments that opened some private part of them, and for once it didn't hurt like they knew it would. The star map on the wall with that usual red arrow, don't you wish you were here? The number of light years until the next rest stop, and maybe at least where they left the car, even if the goddamn keys they can't find are lost by now in some deep pocket of space too unlikely to remember. When we were young, we never would have dreamed of admitting we hadn't seen anything yet. We were going around in circles, all our precarious featherweight cargo stuffed into the rusted out Chevy of our lives, with a speaker still hooked on the window so we wouldn't feel so alone. Not of this earth, the man from planet X. We couldn't help humming right through the static with the soundtrack's every flutter and wow. We were never too far from the starlight. The way these people tell it, we may never know what we're missing until it's almost too late. They've been ruined or redeemed, depending on which version needs believing most. That such a thing's actually possible, either way, should be enough. That today anyone understands, in any case, a little more than yesterday, how some of us ended up astonishingly here, dressed in these strange clothes, dazed but remarkably ready to go. One more mysterious incision we can point to in an arm, in a leg, in the thin skin of days that more or less holds us together, where something's been added or taken away, if only we could go back over our arithmetic. We weren't always quite this suggestible, taking whatever instructions we think we can live with. When we wake up, we will remember nothing, or far too much. So often what comes back is sized to fit, no matter what we believe we've lost out on. A few minutes, a day, a leap year, a lifetime. And sometimes We're so anxious to make that up, we do. By now, you've got to know the feeling. You're barely aware of turning the key in the ignition, and out of nowhere, it's you, emerging from the car way too many miles later, with no real idea where you were when the scenery changed. You might think, on the one hand, I'm lucky to be alive, but on the other, every day is like this. Even though both hands on the wheel were yours, steering with an uncanny sense of direction. We're all making it up as we go along. How fast is too fast? When we notice the sky clouding over? What we should have said to the attendant at the starlight, shining his flashlight into our back seat, looking for the same thing we're still looking for today. Some dark secret, more of us than ever, we can probably afford to own up to. And some of us are not about to be stopped, if we can help it. Not this time, now that we're finally getting somewhere. Now that those starlight nights are behind us, when anything forgettable couldn't possibly hurt us beyond belief. And those hours we wasted hoping for once we'd get lucky during the day the earth stood still meant nothing to us with all the time in the world. If the wisdom holds, the first time I woke up as a kid, screaming out of a dream, I really thought it was all over, the little I knew of my life. Yet there I was, a small but undeniable fact, sweating out another troubled night in my own bed. How was I to know the conventional dreamland wisdom? People never quite seem to die in their own dreams. They always catch themselves right before hitting bottom, right before the bullet slams home. And out of nowhere, they're awake, not dead in the least, although they may discover themselves buried deep in pillows, even sheets pulled over their heads. The panicky breathing is one sure sign, the undertaker's own bad dream. Or else in that last split second of REM theatrics, there's a desperate change of scenery. The brain queuing up a sudden reel of beach, blue sky, some non sequitur of gentle wave upon wave, to coax the heart down from the height of its pounding. That familiar way of seducing the dreamer, this is the life, and it only gets better. Don't jump back into the waking world just yet. When people actually die in their sleep, it's nothing they ever imagined happening to them, not even remotely in their wildest dreams. They're out there on the edge of the deepest breath of their lives, in sleep so profound there's no analysis, no chance of understanding later. And that has to hurt, no matter what hope they stacked against hope. As much as dying at high noon, fresh out of dreams, where against all odds of recurring circumstance, they go on living with a light on the nightstand, a cool drink of water, and someone at whatever door delivering the promise we believed when we were small. It's only a dream. How happy we used to be to hear that, and in no time we feel ridiculously brave. We'd be dead to the world all over again. Those were the days we were going to live forever, and sometimes it still feels miraculously possible. Tonight, I might go over Niagara Falls in a barrel, snuggled up to the most beautiful woman in the world. And chances are, if the wisdom holds, we'll make it. We'll both live another day to tell anything we recall. On mornings with the sun too fat and sassy in the window, it's no small wonder we're waking up at all, coming even halfway back to our senses. It's another day. The monster at the foot of the bed that seems so real, so murderous, so hungry it could eat every one of our dreams for breakfast. And we open our eyes
remembering from last time how we'll have to give it everything we've got. I'd like to read just two of the shorter sections from what I think of as a long suite of poems called Lost in the Fire that Michael mentioned. Essentially, a poem in 10 poem parts that's sort of my imaginative investigation of a phenomenon known as spontaneous human combustion. That case where people inexplicably burst into flame. I'll read the first section. The first poem is called A Starter Kit, and the other section I'd like to read called What a Town, What a Woman, What a Time. The first poem introduces really the whole rest of the longer poem, and it essentially prepares the way for 9 stories that follow this introductory poem. So the introductory poem and then one of those stories. Lost in the Fire, and it begins with a little quote from investigator Vincent Gaddis, who says, "This localization of terrific heat in a body, yet not extending to flammable objects nearby, is the great mystery of SHC, spontaneous human combustion." A starter kit. When it's a storage shed, garage, nightmare of an attic, or one more derelict warehouse lit up in the night, and authorities can't find any neighborhood kid with his pocket full of matches and a bad idea, we might have to settle for the textbook explanation. Rags and gasoline, the invariably poor ventilation, heat gradually building to the delicate point of ignition, and suddenly it's a plausible last resort, spontaneous combustion. The smallest leap of faith should tell us it can happen this way, too. People burn. It's humanly possible, and for no good reason experts can agree on. Burn in minutes from the inside out with something so hot it takes people who burn for a living, professionals at their incinerators, hours of patient stoking to achieve that degree of obliteration. If you're a physician in the 17th century, you've decided by now the long and immoderate use of spirituous liquors. Firewater, white lightning, smoking skull, and boiler maker. Small wonder, then, the number of folks lit up all over the world. The woman in the grocery line checks out the latest theory. UFO aliens detonating their overgrown science homework through a kind of remote and fiendish mind control. In the coroner's office, they've always been fond of death by misadventure, hinting at some vague, misguided bravery. In centuries of monasteries, it's a matter of pious record, where, being eternal optimists, they called it the fire from heaven. And when it struck, it struck completely down. Historically, incredibly, and simply, people have burned. And they will burn again. They'll flame and sear until there's no fire left in them, until it goes out without touching another single thing in the cold water flats of their lives, until what's left is essence, a scattering of blackened DNA, a residue on the floorboards while the curtains continue to blow, while their chairs and the tables they set remain undaunted, anticipating the arrival of some altogether splendid company. Maybe it's the twisted inverse of the ballyhooed lightning that charged the planet's primordial soup, and just the right amino acids twitched into recognizable life when however many eons later something crawled out of the water, discovered fire on the beach, and told stories around it all night, convinced this was a step in the right direction. And then just one of those stories, What a Town, What a Woman, What a Time. In 1780, in Limerick, Ireland, the boarding house keeper O'Neill is awakened out of the sleep of his life by a lodger who insists O'Neill follow him back to his room. From the doorway, they stare together at the charred body of Mrs. Peacock, a rumor on the floor above, lying flaming and red as copper in the lodger's otherwise dark chamber. By the glow of Mrs. Peacock, they can just barely make out the hole she's burned through the ceiling. As a boy out walking the streets at night, our lodger was already in the habit of looking up. The Big Dipper was a cinch. Then Cassiopeia, the lady in the chair. Every glittering jewel in Orion's belt. But this gaping hole overhead in the shape of a woman prone, this dark smoldering, this anti-constellation, surely must have startled him. A flimsier universe than he dreamed, and small enough to fall out the bottom of without warning. On other nights, he might have prayed for something close to this occurrence, lighted a galaxy of candles in the asking of some kind of demonstrable love into his life, but what exactly was he supposed to do now? An entire tavern's worth of stout, and still Mrs. Peacock is nothing he ever could have imagined. The too many dim light years she traveled to get here? Maybe. Maybe he can imagine those. Some older kids explain how the rock he'd found near the schoolyard was probably a meteorite, how it had come from a completely different world. Eventually he knew even better. It was a fragment of that other world itself, now insinuated smack in the middle of his. A survivor of the scariest falling dream in the firmament, where everything's always burning down and too quickly out. By the time he discovers that much, it's already cool, cold, strangely familiar in his hands. Or O'Neill's own theory, that once was a woman so hot that she turned flaming red quite a lot. When her ardent desire translated as fire, she shocked men more often than not. UFO abductions, dream parasitology, spontaneous human combustion. For me, a phenomenon just as hard to believe as all these things are bed and breakfast. I believe all the rest. I don't quite believe bed and breakfast. This is a poem that's dedicated to a man when I went visiting out west for a bunch of readings. Didn't know me personally, but had only read the work and read a lot of the older work and said, I think I see the kinds of places you like, but I've got one problem. In Salt Lake City, we had to get you into a bed and breakfast. This is a poem in his honor. It was also my only night in a bed and breakfast. I think it's great for people like that sort of thing. I'll try to explain here why it may not be for me. The poem then, America's Bed and Breakfast, for G. Barnes, who really did try to book me into something a little more my style. Even though I'm only staying the night, I have a sinking feeling there's going to be trouble. The real guests are talking it up in the living room, as if this is truly the life. What more could people want this far from home than to have every bit of their weariness and hunger taken so personally? Why would anyone settle for less? When they checked in and filled out the card with way too much space for tell us all about yourself, I bet they were more than happy to oblige. I can hear them even now while I'm writing down the only thing I'm sure of after my name and my actual address. I can already tell there's no way I deserve this kind of attention. I travel for the thrill of asserting what I can't be expected to know. Because I enjoy the molecular rearrangement that being a stranger occasions, I don't necessarily want to feel as if I'm somehow fitting into the familiar chambers of my life one more time. It's as if my Aunt Ida suddenly was named the nation's hotelier. And from now on, there'll be no such thing as too much potpourri, too many of those giant ceramic pitchers on hallway tables.
dried flowers sprouting from the mouths of all the antiques in the land. Had I been St. Louis, Salt Lake City, Sausalito, New Orleans, had Ida beckoning from every porch swing throughout charm-smitten New England. It's not enough that this place has taken its name from some official roster of the atmospherically correct. Each room has its own ambiance spelled out. The salt air, the espresso, the Battle of Gettysburg room. And there's no major hoople from my Sunday fun's childhood showing me the way. Guiding star of our boarding house in resplendent fez, calf-calfing through adventure after unlikely adventure. No, my hosts are gentle Dick and Jane, grown serious and pale after too many years of rehabbing their straight and narrow world. 10 minutes of this and my own colors fading. I'm already losing sleep I haven't even thought of yet. I'm actually on my knees, despairing in front of the shelf or two of books they insist on calling the library. Soil conservation, two local histories, the requisite wisdom of Edgar Guest. I grabbed the Boy Scouts survival handbook because now the other guests are chumming up around the piano, lost in a spirited medley of show tunes. And I'm afraid it only gets worse. Some trigger-happy soul bound to pull out a guitar, squeeze off a few rounds of Michael Rowe the Bowman. And then it's kumbaya before you know it. Now I'm turning my polite version of a pillow over and over, looking for the cool side. I really expected to sleep through this night, to wake up for breakfast, fresh squeezed juice, and something like scones, a china cup of exotic decaffeinated coffee, while all these slap-happy pilgrims talk about what's next. The Eichhorns will be, as always, irrepressible. They're excited about meandering through another farmer's market. Nancy and Donna can't wait to be in a boat on the lake. And Dick and Jane might smile and wonder out loud what could possibly be in store for Mr. Misanthrope. I didn't have enough to answer for already. I can dream, can't I? There's a sleepy 1950s aqua-trimmed motel, its vacancy still radiant in neon. The guy at the night desk doesn't want to talk about politics or love, much less about his hula girl tattoo. He doesn't give a damn if I'm in town, on legitimate business, on the lam, on account of any sunburned Donna. And the unassuming key he hands over lets me into the cradle of civilization as I've come to know it room, where I kick off my shoes with impunity and warm up the TV, caressing its lovely rabbit ears. It's my kind of night already. Later, I'm walking the grounds with that plastic bucket in my hands, drawn to the all-night humming of the ice machine. Its cold beauty, the surest sustenance around. And in moments, I'll have something to carry with me for as long as it lasts. Something finally to give away when people come asking. And I can get more if I have to. I can give them all they want. Because sometimes it's hard to remember exactly who you are, what you're doing anywhere. That's when I least believe in talking it out, or sleeping it off, or passing it around the table like bread again till everyone's had his fill. And even if we're supposed to feel like part of the same ridiculous family, no matter how big, how impossibly happy, I can't imagine for the life of me why people would choose to make themselves so much at home that they're perfectly willing to sing along through endless verses full of those same monotonous assurances. No one's a stranger to suffering, but neither will we be strangers to the blessings that seem a little far away right now. Okay, so maybe just one more time. River Jordan is chilly. and why. Bed and breakfast on the other side. It's nice to come home. It's maybe really the message here. This poem's called What Some People Won't Do. If I'm supposed to be doing the laundry and you're supposed to be doing the cooking, then what are we doing here in the bedroom at 4 p.m? So much to be done, and we're getting it exactly backwards. I'm undoing your blouse. You're undoing my serious buckle. You'd think we'd grow up for once in our lives the way so many others seem to do. People who don't even for a minute think of jumping into those neat piles of leaves they've spent the whole day raking. They're so unshakably good at anything they do, it's sickening. Days like this, we're doing the best we can. Sooner or later, we reach that point where there's nothing left to do or undo. We come smack up against the inviolable laws of physics, or else we're simply that exhausted, done in first by the weightlessness, then the unexpected gravity of love. Part of me wants to say, as usual, this is all you're doing, but I don't. Monks, I mean you, on the stereo, was my idea this time. I know what that tune does to you. I'm adding to a list of things that won't get done, and you are nowhere on it. Believe me, there are moments when I realize precisely what I'm doing. And whenever I imagine my life without you in it, doing the difficult work of love you do so well, the grace without end, the heavy lifting of forgiveness, the most demanding of the 101 positions, I come unabashedly undone. Sometimes I get so unreasonably happy, I don't know what else to do. That's when I need you doing the sweet talking for us both, until part of me's whispering again to that part of you that won't be outdone, and suddenly we're taking it once more from the top, Thelonious doing his straight no chasing now. Our much too responsible neighbor, who hates the music we play, will stop his own back-breaking work in the yard just long enough to shake his head, certain that somehow we've done him wrong, that he's discovered a fly in the soup the world's dished out for him today. What's the meaning of this? Exactly what do we think we're doing, unasked for this afternoon in his made-to-order life? Without missing a beat, we'd like to say the backstroke, but we've got to stop falling back on vaudeville, especially if we ever hope to be as good as the next guy at yard work or plumbing or walking the dog, whatever needs serious doing. As far as love's concerned, we're industrious to a fault. We have absolutely nothing to wear, no supper to sit down to. But we're so good at making do, we have to laugh. Another day, it's impossible to feel the least bit sorry for everything we've gone and done again. Vegetarian physics. The tofu that's shown up overnight in this house is frightening. Proof of the law of conservation. Matter that simply cannot be created or destroyed. Matter older than Newton, who knew better than to taste it. Older than Lao Tzu, who thought about it but finally chose harmonious non-interference. I'd like to be philosophical too, see it as some kind of pale, inscrutable wisdom among the hot dogs, the cold chicken, the leftover deviled eggs, but I'm talking curdled soybean milk.
And I don't have that kind of energy.
I'd rather not be part of the precariously metaphorical wedding of modern physics and the ancient Eastern mysteries, but still, whoever stashed the tofu in my Frigidaire had better come back for it soon. I'm not Einstein, but I'm smart enough to know a bad idea when I see it in the icebox, taking up space, biding its time. Like so much that demands our imperfect attention amid the particle roar of the world, going nowhere fast. When I started you on board the UFO, I will leave you on board the UFO. This poem called I Can't Believe the Face on Mars actually jams together a few different decades. This was a more fun-loving flying saucer days, for my money. This was the flying saucer days of good old-fashioned American know-how kookdom. People like George Adamski, Orfeo Angelucci, some of these names mean something to somebody in this room, but they're not telling. The contactees met the benevolent space brothers out on a desert in California or somewhere and came back with the message, don't destroy your planet with bombs. Don't. These were fun-loving folks who wrote books about their rides with the Venusians, their trips to other planets. There wasn't an abductee in the bunch. They were all so happy to go. This combines, some of these people make appearances in this poem. And the poem begins, actually, in the land of what, of course, we've now come to know as the infomercial, one of these half-an-hour commercials. And if some of you know this phenomenon, again, an alleged phenomenon of the so-called face on the Martian surface, this arrangement of rocks or whatever that some people would like to argue into this intelligently made face, all this stuff comes together in what I'd like to think is a love poem. I Can't Believe the Face on Mars, for Patricia. Some guys bought half an hour of TV time to talk about a photo, beamed back by the Viking probe over the red plains of Cydonia, where, to hear him tell it, an ancient Martian race has painstakingly fashioned a monumental human face. It's 2 a.m., and he isn't saying why, but he's hawking his homemade book about what has to be, he insists, the most amazing find of the millennium. And because I Can't Believe the Face on Mars is anything more than an accident of light and shadow, I guess I'm getting hopelessly old. As a kid, I took it all as gospel. UFOs, abominable snowmen, Atlantis, ESP, ghosts, but especially UFOs. I wanted to imagine some life possible worlds away from this one. I needed something flying in the face of the ordinary, so I believed at once in everything inexplicable and in nothing I might actually have to get used to. Arithmetic, piano lessons, religion, undeniable love. These days, we're mostly so sophisticated, it's frightening. We've got acres of the latest radio telescopes scanning the heavens for the same old miraculous sign. Pitch-perfect computerized signals going out by the thousands, wave after differentiated wave, into the vast desolation of space, just on the off chance of discovering that finally, we are not alone. All that, and my Martian scholar friend can't see me making my own faces, can't hear me sighing out loud in my living room. It's unmistakable, the desperation in his face that says we spend our lives looking for clues that might give us something to go on, but we always see more or less than what we want to. In the extravagant night sky, in photos from millions of miles away, in the smoky haze of whatever rooms we're up too late in again. It might as well be my father's face, all business, the telltale serious crease in the brow. In the few grainy photos I have of him, he's somewhere in the gray hills of Pennsylvania, stiffly posing, off by himself, looking as if he'd rather be anywhere else right now, forever. The off-camera voice assures me. The face I should be seeing close up now stretches over a mile of rugged terrain, clearly a sign of constructive, intelligent life, a fierce, enigmatic labor of love. It's obvious this face has become his whole life. No wonder it seems so long. No wonder I can barely make out anything at all. It pales next to those exuberant faces of flying saucer zealots in the 50s. George Adamski, Van Tassel, Orfeo Angelucci, Howard Menger. I couldn't get enough of their colorful anecdotes, tales of contact with actual flying saucer pilots who traveled from unbelievable places just to deliver some cornball message to all humanity through these even more unlikely accidental earthling go-betweens. It happened almost always telepathically. Whether landing in Newark or the middle of nowhere California desert, they didn't have to say a word. But their fledgling emissaries had to, in treatise after crackpot treatise, how they never saw it coming, they never asked for it. The improbable science, mysterious gestures, the hyperbolic beauty of the female crew that always seemed to figure in their breathless recountings. And although invariably they were left to take the long walk back to their rooming houses, to their penny ante labors, they honestly seemed to believe themselves less alone. And being only human, had to talk about it in secret of the saucers. Inside the spaceships, from outer space to you, in wild-eyed books with their own amazing faces staring out from the covers. With time running out, the guy trying to sell me the Martian face turns into every salesman in the world who senses the door slamming shut. He resorts to the quick pitch. Seeing is believing. But I bet he understands it usually works the other way around like this. Probably I'm seeing things I've gone too long without. And because I believe they're finally possible again, they are undeniably here. No spectral hen velvets, no Scottish lake monsters, no out-of-focus Bigfoot. At the moment, I can't even summon up the face of a single waitress who ever said she'd be right back with more coffee in my lifetime. But I have been seeing more of those flashing lights, those odd shapes moving at impossible speeds, the unidentified flying objects of love coming in quietly for a landing through the dark my life's been lately. And now it's the fabled beam of light from the vicinity of the bedroom and you stepping suddenly out of it, radiant in your skin. Even if it's true they never saw it coming, I think Adamski and the rest had to be asking for something, secretly at least, at night, with no one else around. Surely no less a version of prayer than any other. And in the desert, in the woods, in a deserted New Jersey industrial park, they offered it up, in the general direction of heaven. And they couldn't wait for some kind of answer in the thick of their lives. Let's face it. When the answer came to them, no matter how far-fetched, yes, they were surprised, but not completely. And if those saucer disciples were right about the telepathic powers, then you're sure to be thinking what I'm thinking. Where you've come from is less important by far than what we're climbing into, headed wherever now. I'm on board for the long haul, the giddy light years. No matter the unlikely physics, no matter the complex machinery, the inexplicable engines of the heart. Finally, I'm getting that benevolent message directly. Sometimes we are not alone. It almost got lost in those saucer books, amid the vagaries of love and universal understanding, the convoluted discussions of how we might be saved and just in time from some worse part of ourselves. No beings ever could have traveled all that way, thinking any of this would be easy. They must have hoped against hope they'd be lucky enough to find the one person in the world this time who, believe it or not, would believe it when he met them face to face. Maybe that's all the guy on TV's wanted. He's just gone off the air, but a toll-free number keeps flashing, as if he'll be up all night knowing what he knows, and how can anyone else sleep, either. Last night, I watched you sleeping, illumined in the streetlight through the bedroom window, our reliable neighborhood moon. And for a minute, I couldn't believe the grace in your cheekbones, your flickering eyes, the gentle slope of your chin right under that otherworldly smile. I couldn't believe my own eyes. I had to touch you to make sure you simply were, that it wasn't just me in the leftover light from stars no longer actually themselves in the sky. And it wasn't just me. The entire universe took a deep breath, let it slowly out again, an astronomical sigh of relief. What could it hurt to call and tell him, yes, if it means so much to him? He's right. There is a face on Mars beyond the shadow of a doubt. I never really meant to believe otherwise. At least, I can see that much now. Thank you very much.